other animals also, like deer, monkeys, boars, lions, rickshaws, chariots, forest cows, forest asses, tigers, small deer, buffalo, and many other animals who are fully enjoying their lives. Text 21. Kanan tai tata tais tasyai nijushtam vipadnadi karali kara samruha nalini pulina shriyam. There are varieties of deer, such as Karnatra, Ekapad, Ashvasya, Riga, and Kasturi, the deer which bears musk. Besides the deer, there are many banana trees which decorate the small hillside lakes very nicely. And we'll finish up with text 22. Aryasam nandaya satya snana punya tarogaya vilokya bhutesha birim vibhuta vishmayam yayu. There was a small lake named Alajananda in which Sati used to take a bath, and that lake is especially auspicious. All the demigods, after seeing the specific beauty of Kailash Hill, were struck with wonder at the great opulence to be found there. So this text has a purport. According to the commentary called Sri Bhagavad Chandrika, the water in which Sati used to bathe was Ganges water. In other words, the Ganges flowed through the Kailasa Parvata. There is every possibility of accepting such a statement, because Ganges water also flows from the hair of Lord Shiva. Since Ganges water rests on the head of Lord Shiva and then flows to the other parts of the universe, it is quite possible that the water in which Sati bathed, which was certainly very nicely scented, was Ganges water. So, interesting, but a whole description of Lord Shiva's abode. So this whole section of Bhagavatam, several chapters, we've been hearing about Lord Shiva. Different devotees have described the qualities of Lord Shiva, his tolerance, etc. And so today, many verses describing where this great personality lives. But we can ask ourselves, like, why is such a description of Lord Shiva's abode found in Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the Amala Purana, which is meant for, you know, pure devotees who are just interested in hearing the pastimes of Lord Krishna and relishing the nectar of Krishna's pastimes. So we can, this is called philosophical speculation, not mental speculation. So we can try to think why this description might be here. So, of course, one reason is to glorify Lord Shiva, his great character that, of course, you would expect to find a king. You know, a king doesn't live on the street. So similarly, a great personality like Lord Shiva has a residence befitting such a exalted character. But of course, Lord Shiva is not really interested in such opulence. He is the greatest ascetic and yogi. You know, the whole mystic yoga process is coming from Lord Shiva. And just like the six Goswamis of Vrindavan were satisfied sleeping under a different tree every night and, you know, relishing the name, form, pastime, qualities of Lord Krishna. So similarly, Lord Shiva, if he wanted to, he could just be under a different tree every night. But the difference is Lord Shiva is a Grihastha, so Parvati would not be satisfied with this arrangement. So she needs something nice to say. But Shiva himself, he doesn't mind. So, and these kind of verses, you know, in a world where there's more and more extinction of species, endangered animals, just, you know, disruption of natural habitats for commercial purposes and agriculture, land, you know, building more commercial interests, etc. Then, you know, we're ruining the natural beauty of the world. And so these verses kind of serve to remind us that this natural opulence is actually what is satisfying for the human beings. You know, the nice trees, so many varieties of trees were mentioned here, and flowers. And hardly people, you know what trees, which trees, which nowadays. And so then there's nice, beautiful lakes. But these things are becoming non-existent now. It's that you can't find clean water, you can't find clean air, especially India and China, other countries. There's so much air pollution and water pollution, noise pollution. So we're just contaminating the whole atmosphere. And this is the progress of modern society, that we degrade everything. So Bhagavatam reminds us of the actual opulence, which is the natural opulence of the world. And a bit further on, I won't read it today, but later on in verse 28, it says that this Kailash Hill, which he described, is situated near the residential quarters of Kuvera, the treasurer of the demigods. And the Vedic scriptures describe that Kuvera is fantastically wealthy. He's, you know, he's collecting all the taxes from the demigods and he's got all the wealth. And it's also mentioned that the desire trees, which we hear about in Krishna Loka, Chintamani trees, no, what are they called? Kapavriksha trees, yeah. These are also found in Kailash, Lord Shiva's abode. And Prabhupada says that's by the grace of Krishna that these desire trees are found also in Lord Shiva's abode. And Prabhupada writes that he says, it thus appears that Kailash has a special significance. It is almost like the residence of Lord Krishna. So, almost, but not quite the same. So what's the difference? We'll talk a bit about that later. What's the difference between Lord Krishna's abode and Lord Shiva's abode? Before that, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Yanti deva vata devam, pitrin yanti pitri vataha, bhutani yanti bhuteja, yanti madhya janokima. So those who worship the demigods will take birth among the demigods. Those who worship the ancestors go to the ancestors. Those who worship ghosts and spirits will take birth among such beings. And those who worship me will live with me. So one reason that such a description of Lord Shiva's abode is in the Bhagavatam, as Bhagavan Maharaj describes, that everything is in the Bhagavatam. There's karma, there's jnana, and there's bhakti. So if someone's not pure in heart and not actually at the very, still they'll get something from Bhagavatam. So if someone is desiring to, you know, worship Lord Shiva, and then they can have information about what is Lord Shiva's abode like. And if they worship Lord Shiva, then this is where they can go. But the devotees, they're not interested in opulence. Although we have, our temples are very opulent. But this is mainly to attract people, attract new people by the opulence and the nice worship. Very gorgeous dress of the deities. This is to attract others as well as to purify us, because in a material world we're thieves, everything's Krishna's property, but we're trying to steal it for our own enjoyment. That's the conditioned soul's mentality. So by giving back very gorgeously to Krishna, then we rectify that stealing mentality. And so although the devotees were not interested in opulence, but if the deities were not here, then the temple would be just like an empty shell. There'd be no life to the temple. If there's no kirtan in the temple, if there's no Bhagavatam class and prasadam distribution at the temple, then it has no life. It has no meaning to the opulence. So this opulence, when it has to be again connected to Krishna. So Prabhupada explains about this point of devotees, they're not interested in opulence. In Bhagavad Gita, where it describes Krishna's shows his universal form. So it's a very wondrous and, you know, great, inconceivable form that Krishna is displaying. There's like thousands of arms and legs and, you know, divine sense, all kinds of jewelry decorations. So it's a very, you know, awe-inspiring form that Krishna displays to Arjuna. But Prabhupada says in one purport that devotees who are correctly situated in a transcendental relationship with Krishna are attracted by loving features, not by a godless display of opulences. So, as the saying, if there's no Krishna, but you have a lot of opulence but no Krishna, this is, as Prabhupada describes, a godless display of opulences. So, and Prabhupada says what devotees are actually attracted to is the loving features, the loving exchanges with the Lord. So this is what we also need to become attracted to. Of course we're attracted to the beautiful form of the deities, but we want to have loving exchanges with the deities and with Krishna's devotees by engaging in service. So when we serve someone, then we become very much attached to them, more and more attached to them. So we find, we experience that when we do some service for Krishna, like sometimes I see in the evenings, it can just be a simple thing like chopping up the vegetables for Crossways. So there's the team in there, and we have the standard in the kitchen that they dress nicely in kurta and either dhoti or pants, white pants. So there's kind of an etiquette there. And so they, just to remind them that they're doing it for Krishna. And then I see that because that service is done a bit later in the evening, so then they might finish toward the Shai Marathi time. So then they come here, and these devotees, whoever is chopping up, will come and take darshan. So it's different when you do service for Krishna. You've just done something for Krishna. Now you come and see the Lord. So you're like, yes, I am your servant. I'm trying to serve you. Like this, then devotees should develop a mood of service and have a loving exchange. So, Prabhupada also says in that purport that the playmates of Krishna, the friends of Krishna, and the parents of Krishna never want Krishna to show his opulences. They are so immersed in pure love that they do not even know that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In their loving exchange, they forget that Krishna is the Supreme. So this is a very nice summary of the relationship that the residents of Vrindavan have with Krishna. And so this description of the abode of Lord Shiva, we find kind of the, you know, what is the inner meaning of this description later in Canto 10, actually. I mean, it's not directly connected, but we just happened to come across it. So I'll read this verse from chapter 10 of Canto 10, verses 2 and 3. Shri Shukru Vaja Bhutasya Nutaro Rupa Sudhito Dhana Vabha Jo Kadaso Bhavane Vamye Mandakin Yam Madhokkaro Varani Madhiram Vipa Adagu Ruta Lochano Sri Chaitane Anuga Yavis Chaitu Vishpite Vane. Shukadeva Goswami said, O King Parikshit, because the two sons of Kuvera had been elevated to the association of Lord Shiva, of which they were very much proud, they were allowed to wander in a garden attached to Kailas Hill on the bank of the Mandakini River. Taking advantage of this, they used to drink a kind of liquor called Vari. Accompanied by women singing after them, they would wander in that garden of flowers, their eyes always rolling in intoxication. So here we find, you know, this is another reason for this description is a test for us. How do we react to such a description of opulence in Lord Shiva's abode? Do we want to go there and have a great time? Or are we not interested on kind of two ends of the scale, and we probably somewhere in between? We want to go there and enjoy such a place, or do we? We're not interested, and we're interested in serving Krishna. That's of course very high level. So, Srila Prabhupada's purport to that verse in Canto 10. This verse mentions some of the material advantages afforded to persons associated with or devoted to Lord Shiva. Apart from Lord Shiva, if one is a devotee of any other demigod, one receives some material advantages. Foolish people, therefore, become devotees of demigods. This has been pointed out and criticized by Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita 7.20. Kamasaste Vitagyana Prabhajantanya Devita. Those who are not devotees of Krishna have a taste for women, wine, and so forth. And therefore they have been described as Vitagyana, bereft of sense. The Krishna consciousness movement can very easily point out such foolish persons, but they have been indicated in Bhagavad Gita 7.15. Where Lord Krishna says, Namam Dushkritano Mula, Prabhajantanya Radhana, Maya Yaparita Jnana, Asrim Padam Ashitaha. Those miscreants who are grossly foolish, lowest among mankind, whose knowledge is stolen by illusion, and who partake of the atheistic nature of demons, do not surrender unto me. So Krishna, Prabhupada gets very heavy now. In this purport, he says, anyone who is not a devotee of Krishna and does not surrender to Krishna must be considered Naradama, the lowest of men, and Dushkriti, one who always commits sinful activities. Thus, there is no difficulty in finding out who is a third class or fourth class man, for one's position can be understood simply by this crucial test. Is he or is he not a devotee of Krishna? So, this is, but as Prabhupada said, he's not, it's not him speaking, it's Krishna speaking. Krishna is calling these people, as that verse is quoted from Bhagavad Gita, that Krishna is saying, whoever doesn't surrender to him is Naradama, Mudha, etc. Asaram. So, this is Krishna's understanding. And so we see that, I just finished that group, but Prabhupada says, why are the devotees of the demigods greater in number than the Vaishnavas? The answer is given herein. Vaishnavas are not interested in such fourth class pleasures as wine and women, nor does Krishna allow them such facilities. So this is some protection that Krishna gives his devotees. That if the devotee is desiring to advance in Krishna consciousness, he mercifully keeps them away from the allurements of Maya, which are so plentiful in Kali Yuga. So that, you know, we cannot really call the followers of Lord Shiva as devotees. If you say a devotee of Krishna, means they're devoted, they have love in their heart. So Prabhupada explains in Bhagavad Gita the difference between like puja and bhaja or worship. So he says you can respect a highly positioned person, but not love them. So like we offer, you know, externally we maybe respect a boss at work, for example, just to, so we, you know, we don't get picked on or something. So the boss likes us, but we don't, you know, we might not love that, but we still respect them. So this is the difference between puja and worship. Puja is the external worship, but bhaja is the devotion. So it's more accurate to say that Lord Shiva has many followers, but they're not devotees as such. They're followers of Lord Shiva. So generally, they want one of two things. Or the devotees of Krishna, they don't want anything. But followers of Lord Shiva, they want something. They want something from their worship. And as I said, Anyabhyalashatashanyam kyanabhyam tamanyabhitam anukumiyana krishnanam shriyam bhakti uttama. So pure devotion is when you don't want anything from your devotion, from your devotion service. You don't want any karma, fruity results, such as, you know, respect or honour or material position, material facilities. No traces of jnana, mental speculation, and so this is the standard of pure devotion. But see, we see that the followers of Shiva, they most certainly want things. They're in one of two classes. Either they want material enjoyment, the just ordinary materialists, so they worship Lord Shiva for a wife or something. And on the other end, there's people who want liberation. So there are, you know, many yogis and impersonals, generally impersonals worship Lord Shiva. So they don't actually, many impersonals, they don't actually believe in Lord Shiva. There's an ashram in Victoria, used to be called the Shiva Ashram. But they don't actually believe in Lord Shiva as a person, they talk about Shiva consciousness, or basically they mean, you know, merging into Brahman. So they're using Lord Shiva as a vehicle to kind of elevate them to this Brahman stage, which is the goal of certain persons. So this is the difference between the followers of Lord Shiva and devotees of Krishna. That the devotees aren't interested in opulence, and they're interested in loving exchanges with the Lord. Because they know, this is what will satisfy my soul, me, myself, the soul. That any kind of material facility is just perpetuating our illusion, because that it's bound to be temporary, as that verse was quoted, they surrender to other demigods. But in another verse it says that the fruits of the demigods are temporary. They can't, and so if it's temporary, then it can't satisfy the eternal soul. But still, Krishna, if someone wants to worship Lord Shiva in that way, then Krishna fulfills everyone's desires to, as it says, as all saints unto me, I reward them accordingly. Everyone follows my path in all respects, O son of Pita. So, it's a very interesting statement. Prabhupada writes that all kinds of spiritual processes are about different degrees of success on the same path. So everyone is looking for Krishna and the loving exchanges with the Lord in any kind of one of the rasas. But you know, people go, you know, they go around that way, the short way, not the direct method. And another example of the how Lord Shiva's followers, just to show their so-called devotion, there's examples in Bhagavatam of Ravana and Banasura, so who are great followers of Lord Shiva, who worshipped him a lot. So there was 10-headed Ravanas described in Canto 10. So it says that Lord Shiva became pleased with 10-headed Ravana and also with Vana. And when they each chanted his glories like bards in a royal court, Lord Shiva then bestowed unprecedented power upon each of them. But in both cases, he was consequently beset with great difficulty. So Lord Shiva gave Ravana and Banasura a lot of power and, you know, material facility. And instead of thanking Lord Shiva for that, then they kind of turned on Lord Shiva. And this abode of Kailash Parvata, when Ravana worshipped Lord Shiva, he misused that power to uproot the Lord's residence, sacred Kailash Parvata. So all these nice trees and birds and animals and flowers, Ravana tried to, you know, mess it all up and create disturbance in Kailash Parvata. And Banasura, Lord Shiva agreed to personally guard Bana's capital, and later he had to fight for Bana against Sri Krishna and his sons. So Lord Shiva is a devotee of Krishna, the greatest Vaishnava, but because of giving boon to Banasura, then he had to fight against Krishna. So everything that's in the Bhagavatam is, you know, we can see it on a, you know, external or like kind of just a upfront, you know, vision, but we need to see, you know, the deeper meaning of how's this helping us in our Krishna consciousness, how's this helping to purify us. So in these nice descriptions of Lord Krishna's abode, sorry, Lord Shiva's abode, Kailash, and we can, you know, test ourselves, like how we react. Is we very pleased to hear about this nice location? Do we want to go there and live the life like the sons of Kaveri did? Or, you know, do we just want to serve Krishna and keep doing our service unconditionally under whatever material facility or arrangement is there? So I'll leave it there and see if anyone has any comments or questions. Yes,
how long did you such a nice class which you guys the origin of yoga? I've Googled it. Do you have?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't back that one up. Yeah.
Sorry.
Maybe don't quote me on that one.
Sorry.
Yeah, the yogis generally worship Lord Shiva, but of course, all the path of yoga, the basic yoga path, is described in the Vedas, and of course the Vedas are coming from Krishna. So, maybe more accurate to say Lord Shiva is the guardian or the, you know, the topmost yogi. He's kind of like given charge of that process of mystic yoga. Any other comments or questions? Yes,
probably. That's what I guess. Probably there is a Mount Kailash in Himalayas, and there is a Kailash Dham in the creation map, which we see in the creation map.
Yeah.
The Kailash Dham comes above, just above the material world. So, what is the two Dhams same? Mount Kailash in Himalayas.
I asked the devotee that yesterday. Yeah, there's the Kailash in the Himalayas. It's a different Kailash in the Lord Shiva's, Sarashiva's planet, outside of the material universe. Yeah, because Lord Shiva, he's not part of the material universe. He's kind of in between the material and spiritual world. So, yeah, he has an abode here. Because, you know, Sarashiva expands into the material world. Every universe has a Lord Shiva as well, to annihilate the universe. And so, you know, he lives, yeah, in Kailash, in that material universe. But there's also a different abode outside of the universe.
So the pastime of Bhagirath praying to Lord Shiva for the Ganga to descend to the earth. So that took place in Kailash in that dham, or is it in the Mount Kailash in Himalayas?
Bhagirath Maharaj, I'm not sure exactly what, because the Ganga is coming into the universe from. So, you know, from Lord Vishnu pokes the hole in the universe. So, just logically thinking that it would be within this universe, within this world, as I was said in this purport, that, because the Ganges water is first coming onto the head of Lord Shiva, and then going to other parts of the universe. So it's within the universe. Yeah. Is that okay? Any other comments or questions? Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much.